To much of the rest of the country, Oregon is a green and moist place with lots of rain, and sure, parts of it are. Most of the people in Oregon live in the Willamette Valley, which is plenty green and plenty moist. Then there's the huge expanse of Oregon east of the Cascade Mountains, which is largely high desert, greater elevations, and lesser rainfalls. This is the part of the state that is the reason for being for the Oregon Natural Desert Association, which celebrates its 30th birthday this year. Let's find out more about ONDA and what it does. Brett Fenty is the executive director at the Oregon Natural Desert Association. Hi, Brett.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here today. First, the name. Is there a distinction between natural desert and some unnatural kind?
Yeah, I think when folks came together, 30 years ago, it was actually group of folks who would, I think, affectionately refer to themselves as desert rats. they put out an ad in the Bend Bulletin and said, hey, if you love Oregon's high desert like we do, meet up with us. And a group of folks actually met a local pub. Each of them threw $5 in a hat, and that became the beginning of what now today is the Oregon Natural Desert Association. And the reference to natural is simply the fact that at that point there was a lot of conversion of our deserts happening, making them unnatural. And so the idea was we wanted to preserve kind of the natural deserts that Oregon's been blessed with, places like Steens Mountain, the Owyhee Canyonlands, Heart Mountain, all these wonderful places, the John Day, that we know and love, and make sure that they're left intact for future generations.
When you talk about conversion, you mean conversion to agricultural lands or other uses?
Yeah, I mean, it can be anything from transportation, lots of roads being built, to energy, both transmission lines and energy production, mining, agricultural conversion, recognizing that all of those have a role in economic development in the region, but that it's also really important as we develop places for economic development that we also maintain and preserve some places so that future generations can enjoy the wild places, the wildlife that, we enjoy today.
Brett, how much of Oregon is desert? I mean, there's so much land east of the Willamette Valley, obviously, and east of the Cascades.
Yeah, I think as you rightly pointed out, it's funny, I've sat on, down with many of folks over the years and who are even from the state or maybe uh-huh. not, and their preconception is that Oregon's all moss and rain-soaked forests, and the reality is it's about half of our state is desert, which means that it, receives rainfall, a precipitation of less than 14 inches a year, and, those areas in Oregon are typically high desert, what we call, so it's a lot of the sagebrush ecosystems. There are true deserts, the Alvord Desert on the east side of Steens Mountain, those kind of places that, are more what people think of, shifting sand dunes, the kind of dry lake playas. But a lot of it is high desert, higher elevation, typically characterized by sagebrush, wildflowers, juniper. That's a lot of what Oregon has to offer.
So high desert and true desert, not exactly the same?
They're both deserts. It's how it is with wordplay. They both are deserts. It's just how we describe them.
We're talking to Brett Fenty, the executive director of the Oregon Natural Desert Association. You heard about its humble beginnings in a tavern in Bend. It doesn't surprise me for some reason, Brett, that it started over beer in Bend.
Yeah, that's it's going to become the norm in Bend nowadays. But, so it is. I think it is appropriate.
And you can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So then how does the Oregon Natural Desert Association help? What kinds of things do you do?
Sure. Well, our mission is really straightforward. We work to protect, defend, and restore Oregon's high desert. So on the protection end, we're advocating for the permanent protection of, a few million acres in Oregon's high desert, places like Steens Mountain, which was permanently protected as Oregon's first desert wilderness in 2000, other places like Badlands or the Oregon Badlands or Spring Basin Wilderness along the John Day River. We work really hard and empower people to make their voices heard to get those areas permanently protected. Defense is sometimes necessary, either because most of these lands we're talking about, the vast majority of Oregon's high desert is publicly owned land. It's owned by you and I and everyone else in the country. And, sometimes there are proposals to develop those lands that don't really line up with federal law. One recent example is the idea of putting wind turbines all over Steens Mountain. That was something that ONDA legally intervened in that case and thankfully prevailed so that Steens Mountain will continue to be the wild place we know. ONDA, of course, has worked in a lot of other areas to facilitate accelerate renewable energy development. We just felt like that was the right idea, but the wrong place. So that legal engagement is part of our mission. And then lastly, we do restoration work. There are places that have been significantly impacted over the years, either by invasive species or livestock grazing or off-road vehicle use or other forms of recreation. And so we have folks that are about 1,000 volunteers a year out on the ground doing trail maintenance, doing stream restoration, removing fences that impede wildlife habitat. One of the best examples of that was in about 20 years ago, Onda successfully worked to get livestock grazing removed from Heart Mountain National Antelope Refuge, which is one of the homes of kind of the last and largest populations of pronghorn antelope in the West. And over 20 years since livestock grazing was removed, volunteers removed over 250 miles of barbed wire fence to make that area more kind of conducive to wildlife. Pronghorn antelope are actually the fastest land mammal in North America. They move at speeds of up to 60 miles an hour, so you can imagine a barbed wire fence is kind of an unpleasant surprise and, you know, can really impact pronghorn populations. Thankfully, since that work began, that fencing I, you know, commented on is about the equivalent, to give your listeners a sense of the scale of a project like that, is about the equivalent of about 12 747 aircraft in terms of tonnage. So it was a lot of work over 20 years, but pronghorn populations are about seven times what they were when that project started. So it's been a huge, huge win for wildlife.
Wow, 12 747s by weight, but pretty much the distance from Grants Pass to Portland in the fencing distance.
Yeah, exactly. And we've, you know, we always say, you know, when you look at the fence that we have removed there, as well as other places across the state, you could go back and forth across the state a few times with that amount of barbed wire.
That is a lot of barbed wire. So I want to come back to some of these other points you raised, though, about, for example, facilitating renewables. Obviously, people concerned about Steens Mountain and the view don't want wind turbines up there, but are there places then where you've recommended where there could be solar or wind installations in the desert?
Yeah, there are. We've worked closely with a number of renewable energy developers over the years. There's actually a report that we produced years ago, almost a decade ago, on our website that kind of did a mapping analysis to identify areas that have high, moderate or low social and environmental conflicts to give developers a sense of kind of what they should be looking at as they propose different developments. And, thankfully, a number of the developments that have been proposed have fallen in those low conflict areas. We recognize that there's no such thing as development without impact. It's just a matter of kind of prioritizing those, developments in places that have the lowest amount of impact.
Is there any conservancy or land trust aspect to what you do? Do you do things like conservation easements, that sort of thing?
Yeah, we have on a very limited basis. It's interesting that you point that out. Onda just went through a strategic planning process, and land acquisition and easements were a robust kind of part of the conversation, and it's really the only tool in the toolbox that we haven't used extensively in the past, but it is a tool that we are looking to in the future that we think could be important to our work over the next 30 years.
We're talking to Brett Fenty, who's the executive director of ONDA, the Oregon Natural Desert Association, celebrating 30 years protecting high desert in Oregon, and true desert for that matter as well. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation by phone. Some questions or comments about high desert or natural desert and its protection. 800-838-3760. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Well, then your focus obviously is so much on public lands up to this point. Is this a particularly auspicious time in American history to be in this line of work?
Yeah, auspicious maybe. Yeah, I'm not sure that's the adjective I would have used, but I think most of us have been pretty troubled about the direction that the public kind of discussion has taken around public lands. I think most of us who live in Oregon and live around the West recognize the incredible values that public lands have for us as Oregonians. You know, we hunt, we fish, we hike, we backpack, what you name it. It's hard to find many Oregonians that go through a day or a month without having some sort of significant interaction with their surrounding public lands. And, clearly there have been a lot of ideas forwarded here in the state and around the country about essentially questioning whether public lands should exist. We saw bills out of Utah in which Representative Rob Bishop proposed to release millions of acres of public lands And, you know, even here in Oregon, we saw the state legislature studying the, proposing to study the disposal of public lands here in the state. Obviously, we think that's a terrible idea. These public lands are kind of key to our quality of life for the recreational reasons that I mentioned, but also clearly for, you know, how they contribute to our economy, you know, clean water, clean air, wildlife, the spiritual connection that, you know, many people have with them. And so that's, you know, that has been an unfortunate shift in our work, in that we've had to, you know, focus a lot of attention on helping people, or reminding people of the values of those public lands. And, you know, through in recent months, what we've done is formed what we call our Public Lands Leaders Program. And the whole idea of that is essentially to help people tell their stories about why public lands are important to them, and to remind other people, you know, about why public lands are important. So, you know, we have folks from around the state who are essentially hosting gatherings at their homes, you know, telling their own stories and hopefully inspiring people to step up and make their voice heard for public lands.
We've got a couple of phone calls here. Let's start with Urban, and I don't see a town here. Urban, where are you calling from?
Creswell, Oregon.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm a motorcyclist, off-road motorcycle guy, and there's a trail called the Oregon Backcountry Discovery Route, and I'd be interested to see what this gentleman's take on that, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing for the way that his organization looks at it.
Okay, excellent question. Thanks for that, Urban. So where do you stand at on Brett about off-road vehicle use?
Yeah, sure. I'm not familiar kind of with the specific route that the gentleman outlined, mm-hmm. but you know, our position on off-road vehicle use has been simply that, you know, that it should be limited to existing roads and trails, that there needs to be travel management planning that makes sure that it's done in a responsible way. Historically, especially in Oregon's high desert, a lot of lands were open for cross-country travel. And I think most people recognize now that, one, the erosion that can take place from those kind of off-trail travel, as well as what we're really dealing with a lot in Oregon's high desert, is a lot of the invasive species. Cheatgrass is, you know, a big issue that contributes to fire in the area. So, you know, when we're engaging in the what's called the NEPA process, the National Environmental Policy Act, where all of us as public citizens have an ability to kind of make our voices heard about public lands management, you know, our emphasis is ensuring that we're keeping off-road vehicle travel to those existing routes so that we're not seeing the kind of impacts off-road, off-trail, you know, that throughout Oregon's high desert.
So this trail okay, that trail okay, but the shortcut between them not okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard thing to do. These vehicles have become more and more powerful. You know, they can go places they couldn't have gone in the past. And, you know, you can see how it's tempting for somebody to look at they're on a map and they're on one route and there's another one, you know, a few miles away, and they think, well, I can just cut across between them. And, you know, thankfully there are a lot of folks that are very responsible and a lot of folks within the off-road vehicle community that are trying to really hammer home that message and make sure that, you know, maybe past behaviors are addressed and, you know, people are sticking to the existing routes.
Okay, another call here from Ann in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Brett Fenty from the Oregon Natural Desert Association.
Thank you. When I go to the high desert, I see a lot of irrigated high water crops like alfalfa and mint. Now, aren't they tapping into fossil water? And once the aquifer is emptied, it's all over? Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate that. So, what do you find about water use in the desert, and what's the on to stand on it?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it varies by region, of course, by the aquifer that they're tapping into. But this is a big issue. I think it's been was well covered by the Oregonian earlier this year. We saw, for instance, out in the Malheur Lake Basin, that there have been a tremendous number of groundwater wells drilled over the last decade, and that groundwater levels are dropping. And I think there is going to be a moment of reckoning in that basin. People are working on this right now to try to figure out, how do you address the overutilization of groundwater? I think it's probably going to be an issue that's raised in other areas as well. So it is something we need to get ahead of. I think we need to have more rigorous permitting associated with it. It is not to the benefit of a lot of the folks who are using groundwater either to have a bunch of new folks coming in and using groundwater, which makes the existing use unsustainable. So I think your caller points out a really great issue, and it's something that a lot of us are kind of putting our minds to and trying to address, because as it currently stands, I think it's hard to for anyone to suggest that there hasn't been an overallocation of groundwater in a number of basins throughout eastern Oregon.
Brent, you mentioned at the beginning that in passing about Owyhee Canyon Lands, which was proposed as a national monument but didn't get that designation. What happened there? What was the issue?
Yeah, well, the Owyhee Canyon Lands, for listeners who aren't familiar with it, it's truly one of the most spectacular landscapes, not only that Oregon has to offer, but our country has to offer. Largest herd of California bighorn sheep in the country, second largest population density of raptors in the West. It's a place that's well known for rafting, for kind of really wild remote hiking opportunities. It is just, an incredibly wild place. You know, ironically, the area on the Idaho side of the border, the Owyhee Canyon land spans kind of western part of Idaho, northern part of Nevada, and up into Oregon, with most of the area being in Oregon. Idaho protected its side of the Owyhee in 2009, but Oregon has yet to give any sort of permanent protection to our side of the Owyhee, whether it be wilderness, a national monument, national park, you name it. And, you know, I think what happened is a few things. I think, one, we just ran out of time. Two, there was a lot of misconceptions about, what a national monument or wilderness might mean. And three, I think it's impossible to, for anyone to suggest that the Malheur occupation, which, clearly raised tensions in the area and took up a lot of time and energy and money, wasn't a distraction from that. And I don't think we just had time to fully recover. I think, anyone that looks at that area feels like it's inevitable that it will ultimately get the protection it deserves. Our hope is that by the time it gets the protection it deserves, a lot of the values that are, so important in that area haven't been degraded significantly.
All right. A lot of work obviously still left to be done. Brent Fenty is the executive director of ONDA, the Oregon Natural Desert Association, which celebrates 30 years in business this year. Brent, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Yeah, and I would just say for any of your listeners who want to get involved, please take a look at our website at www.onda.org.
Couldn't be easier. ONDA.org. Brent Fenty, thanks again for joining us on the Jefferson
Exchange. Thank you for having me.